manufactured in Massachusetts. Even though the company is owned by Hitachi. And even the stuff that's being sold to Japan is being made in Massachusetts. There's another company called Harris, what used to be known as Harris, but the folks who used to work for Harris actually bought the company from Harris, and it's now called Gates Air, which is a very old company, and all their stuff is manufactured in Quincy, Illinois, and Florida. So I don't know if your statement is quite relevant.
And if we buy an American automobile, are all the parts manufactured in America? If we buy a Japanese automobile, are all the parts manufactured and assembled in Japan? Looks like everything is international these days, isn't that sort of true, Eric?
Yes, it is, but do you realize that Sony, for a billion years, had all their engineering done, or most of their engineering done, in San Jose, California?
I don't think I knew that. San Jose is where the engineering was done, but Sony, I'd like to believe, was being manufactured in Southeast Asia. Is that true?
Well, today most of Sony is manufactured in China. But believe it or not, the Trinitron and the Trinitron tubes and the Trinitron TV set, the tubes themselves were manufactured in California. A lot of the final assembly was done in California, but a lot of the component parts was manufactured in Japan. But that was years ago. The broadcast industry is somewhat interesting. Excuse me. Most of the American-based broadcasters still do all their manufacturing here, but if you're buying chips from Texas Instruments or from Cyrix or from Intel, you're probably getting your chips, including Motorola. Your chips are being manufactured in Malaysia, Singapore. Buy an Icon camera, it ain't made in Japan, it's made in Thailand.
In the next 6 months, so to speak, if I go out and buy a popular brand of ATS-free television set, the new standard that's coming down.
You're going to buy it from Samsung, which is made in South Korea.
So you're saying Samsung is going to lock up a big percentage of the market in the United States? Is that what you're predicting, Eric?
No prediction required, because they actually hold a corner of the market in flat panel TVs for many years now. Although you've got companies like Vizio and stuff like that, which is coming out of China. But interestingly enough, most of the displays are manufactured by three companies. And the glass and the actual displays themselves are made by some Japanese company that manufactured them in Thailand, Malaysia, and China. And that's where the screens themselves come from. The assembly and the circuit design come from various different places. Some manufactured in Japan, some manufactured out in this country. Engineering is an interesting aspect of it. But assembly, that's another story.
So, a big manufacturer is going to be, I think you said Samsung. Will there be any other brand that I can buy of ATSC-3 6 months from now? Go ahead.
Now, if you go to the store now and you look at the various different names, all of them will have an ATSC-3 set available. Actually, you got to remember that the company called LG, they bought Zenith many years ago. You may remember LG, they call it Life's Good, but the actual LG really originally stood for Lucky Gold Star, and that was the Korean manufacturer. And because they bought Zenith, they also bought all the patents. So, you get the idea.
Anybody any further questions on this subject before we go over to N2EO? Give me a call, that is right now, K2RIW.
Yeah, to close to the comment I was going to make, Dick, about the emphasis and the microsecondes for amateur FM and commercial 5KC communication, that's 530 microseconds, that rose off from 300 to 3,000 at 6 dBs. So I assume what you would do is just take the reciprocal of 75, but that will give you approximately the frequency. Am I right, Eric?
There you are, Howard.
I think you said I was right. So wait a second, because you teed it up too fast. Echolink didn't turn over fast enough.
Yeah, I said you're in the ballpark.
Yeah, the reciprocal of 75 microseconds is 13.3 kilohertz.
Yeah, so when you're dividing the RC network is 2 pi over RC times the frequency. So you're looking, like for 5 kilohertz, you're looking for a 300 cycle. So you're looking, you know, 0.707 at 45 degrees at 300, and then you start to roll off. And as far as the pre-emphasis, you have a brick wall filter or 18 dBs of octave filtering. The FCC requires for your splatter filter. So when you come out of the audio, just before you go into the modulator, after you come out of the audio clipping, you have a second order filter. Go ahead, Chick.
I thank you. I got no further comments on all of the above. Anyone else got any further comments?
In the FM broadcast world,
you can either do the pre-emphasis in the transmitter, but what we do a lot these days is with the fancy compression companding systems we have that make the station sound loud, you're allowed to do the pre-emphasis in the audio before you even hit the modulator. So if there are transmitters that will take a flat input and do whatever it is that you feed into it, you just have to have it somewhere.
D-2-D-I-G. Mr. D-I-G, give me the full call and your name and go right ahead with your comments, sir.
Bill Delta 2, Delta India Golf. My name is Don, and I'm interested in putting a television in my shack, which is a garage that's separate from the house. And I picked up a little TV antenna and a rotor, and I'm looking at these ATSC boxes. Should I wait until early next year and get the most modern? I mean, is the difference going to be that great? And will the old signal be obsolete? Will I have to purchase a new box?
I'm going to let Eric answer that. K-E-2-E-J, K-2-I-W.
You want to, I had a little trouble hearing what he said, Dick, so repeat it for me.
He's basically asking that got a television set in a separate part of the house, in the shack, in the garage. Will he have to change all of his equipment? Will his current equipment work with the new standard? And I think the answer is no. I think he's going to be forced to buy new equipment, whether it be a converter box, and I think there's not going to be a converter box, but I believe the current television set for over-the-air broadcast he is using right now, I think becomes useless on the new standard. However, the rate at which you change over, abandon the old standard and establish the new standard, I'd like to believe that'll be a tapered-off situation where the FCC and the broadcasters know that not everybody's going to change on day number one. So you're going to have a little bit of a trade-off period where both standards are present, is my guess. Confirm that for us, Eric. K-E-2-E-J, K-2-I-I-W.
2-I-W, K-E-2-E-J. There is no talk about ending the current standard. Looking at the current standard at least for 20 years at this point. But what's going to happen is that your wonderful 1080i, good bandwidth, great motion pictures, will start to get a little crummier looking, simply because what's going to happen in each locale is that, first of all, you have multiple stations being owned by the same organization. So what they will do is they'll put up one ATSC 3 transmitter, a new standard, and they will consolidate all their streams into an existing ATSC ABC1 standard or ABS-B standard. So you'll continue to broadcast in ABS-B or your current TV standard, and that will stay there for a long time. It's not going to go anywhere. But get the new stuff, you're going to need a new receiver, and nobody's talking about making converters at this point, so who knows? That's all up in the air. But as far as, you know, having to throw away your TV set, that's not going to happen for a long, long time.
Sounds like fairly good news as I see it. Doug, KD2DIG, K2LIW.
KD2DIG, and Don, Delta Oscar November. Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. Back to Ned.
Rich, N2EO. You wanted to ask a question or make a comment? Now's your time. N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Compared to the other questions, I think mine is very straightforward. Remember we had discussed the fact that the batteries in my wheelchair are not holding a charge, instead it's because I was deep cycling. I didn't realize not supposed to do that with lead acid batteries. I went on Amazon.com today. I'm happy to say batteries are not as expensive as cycling. But there were many batteries that cover my chair, which is an MV5 by HubAround, and they're all different prices. I don't know why. Could you take a look for me?
Are the batteries containing different ampere hour ratings is question number one. Are they all deep cycle? Question number two. And even deep cycle batteries, I'm going to ask Eric this one. When it comes to a so-called deep cycle or marine battery, I believe even on those, when you discharge them beyond the 50% point, I think you're doing some permanent damage to the battery. Let's see if Erica agrees on that. He's the closest thing we've got to a battery expert, as I remember. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Are we talking about conventional lead acid batteries, or are we talking about gel cell?
Whatever he calls the deep cycle batteries that are used on his mobile chair. Eric, go ahead.
All right, let's put it this way. Deep cycle batteries, like marine deep cycle batteries, you charge them, you let them go below 20%, you're asking for trouble. Gel cell, you let them go below 15%, you're looking at a dead battery. After three or four more charge cycles, they just don't hold up, because what will happen is if they start to charge up, they'll start to gas on you. And that's not a good thing.
So if we made a general rule of thumb, no matter what kind of a battery you got, if you're conservative and only discharge them to the 50% point, are you likely to get a lot of life? The problem that Rich is having is his batteries, after some pretty deep discharge, are not holding charge. N2EO, K2RIW.
Dick, this is stickler. On the chair, it says recharge every night. I didn't do that. I thought I was smarter than them. But they outsmarted me. All the batteries I see, 12 volts, 35 amps, every one of them. I don't know what the difference is in them. I know they go in cities. They get 24 volts total.
D6DPC with a comment.
Eric, do you sort of agree, Eric, that no matter what the battery is, if you're a super conservative person, you don't want to discharge beyond 50%, otherwise you're starting to do some damage. Is that roughly true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. There are some marine batteries that will let your deep cycle, you know, let your discharge to it almost as low as 6 and 7%. But they usually recommend that there's some sort of smarts connected to it to prevent it from going any lower than that. You can actually bring a deep cycle battery back to life by doing some nefarious things to it. But now, any good design is going to have a battery charge controller, which will essentially say you've the resistance to the battery is such that you've gone to the point where I ain't going to let you go anymore. If you're talking about something that doesn't have any intelligence about it, the intelligence has to be, you know, from the user.
This is DPZ with a comment.
When we were on this subject 6 months ago, Eric, we got on the subject of these fancy electronic circuits for recharging lead-acid batteries called Rejuvenator. Can that Rejuvenator take any of these batteries that that Rich has that are not holding a charge and give some life back to them? To your knowledge, is that Rejuvenator something he should be using is question number one. And of course, where his chair manufacturer recommended he charge it every night, we now know he should have been doing that. But what do we know about that Rejuvenator we were hearing about 6 months ago? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
No, if I remember correctly, the Rejuvenator that we were talking about was for NiCads and nickel metal hydride. It all depends upon the chemistry of the battery that you're working with. That's one thing. The other thing, is it a sealed battery, and is it vented? If we're talking about gel cells, the only thing you really want to do with them is throw them out. If you're talking about a traditional lead-acid battery, you can, in fact, play games with them, but you have to monitor the temperature, you have to make sure that you don't overgas them, you have to make sure that they have enough electrolyte in them. I mean, it's a little bit of a complex issue. Yes, you know, you do it properly, you can actually get some life back out of it. You do it improperly, you wind up bending the plates and they short together, and you have a bunch of lead garbage. So, really, the best way to deal with batteries is to take care of them. And, you know, don't let them go beyond a certain specific gravity of their electrolyte. Now, Rich, in his condition, I'm surprised that the wheelchair doesn't have any smarts connected to it. You know, it's a little bit of a dangerous issue because you're generating hydrogen gas, and if you have a sealed battery, that can be a real problem.
The specific gravity with a hydrometer, Rich, you'll find out what the specific gravity is. That may be your whole problem.
It sure would be nice if Rich's chair was designed so well that it had the equivalent of a gas gauge telling him you have 80% left, 60% left, 30% left, and it starts lighting up red lights saying, don't discharge beyond this point, otherwise you're going to be doing damage. It would be nice if it had that, a gas gauge. My electric shaver, made by Norelco 15 years ago, it's got a very nice gas gauge. And here I am 15 years later using the exact same lithium ion batteries in my portable electric shaver. 15 years later, and I use it every single day. The thing still keeps working like a charm. So a good gas gauge is a great thing. Now, the thing you were complaining about, Rich, I'm pretty sure your chair doesn't have a gas gauge. I wish it did. And you were talking about replacement batteries, and some of them are very expensive, and some of them are very cheap. Give us some range of prices, Rich. How expensive were the expensive ones? Is it only one brand that's super expensive? How cheap were the cheap ones? How many brands are cheap? Give us a few words on what you've seen so far, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, actually, there is a gauge, but it goes down very rapidly now. I'm afraid to even go to the Chinese restaurant because they don't have much capacity like they used to. It's LEDs, and you can see them going down very clearly. Cheap batteries, and the higher price one not that much. But I'm wondering why they have so many different makes and models for this chair. It's a very popular chair called an MV5. Give me your opinion, Dick, if you can take a look. Can't walk tonight, maybe on the next day.
But give me a range, Rich. How many dollars are the cheap batteries, and how many dollars are the expensive batteries? And I know you need two of them, each of them are 12 volts at 35 ampere hours. What kind of dollars are we talking about here, Rich? Go ahead.
Amazon.com sells them in pairs if you need to. They range from around $110 a pair to $130 a pair. Not very much. What's confusing me is which pair to take. They all say compatible with MV5 wheelchair.
Now, some of us may have some brand loyalty. Name some of the brands that you remember seeing, Rich. So, they range in price from $110 to $130 for a pair. By way of car battery prices, those are very desirable sounding numbers for a pair. What brands are we talking about here? Are some of them popular brands? N2EO, K2RIW?
And what type of batteries are they?
Okay, guys. Eric, I think they're wet acid batteries and a steel. And Dick, I don't remember the brands. All the same.
K2UPS.
Let's see what the other Rich has to say on this, because he uses batteries and does some pretty deep discharging when he's running portable operation. K2 Uncle Pipes, Papa Sierra. Probably mobile. Probably in Pennsylvania. K2 RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
UPS, all the way up Pennsylvania, a little bit east of Pittsburgh at the moment. It's funny that he mentions these batteries because I was looking at the exact batteries last night myself on Amazon for when I'm doing special events and I want to run the 100-watt amplifier for the QRP. And I was looking at 12-volt sealed lead acid AGM, absorbed lead mat batteries, between 30 and 35 amp hours, which is right what Rich is looking at. The least expensive ones that I came across were by a company called Apex, APEX. I think they were about $40 each, but they were getting like almost $20 shipping. And this is through Amazon. The batteries, don't forget to add that in, because I don't know of any of the battery manufacturers that I was looking at that included shipping. It's a very heavy item. But the prices ran as high as $60, $70, $80 for batteries that looked exactly the same, just coming from different manufacturers. So I can't vouch for any of them. I haven't gotten any yet, but that's what I was looking at. And they were all, I believe, none of them were where you would add liquid. They were all sealed, and I believe all the AGM-type sealed battery did. Back to that.
Good information, Rich. And the way Eric was wording it, he thought that the only sealed batteries were gel cells, and I don't think so. I think the modern-day lead-acid battery that used to have caps in the top where you could open them up and measure the specific gravity of the fluid or whatever, I think they are all lead-acid batteries thoroughly sealed these days. They've got some fancy chemistry in there that's supposed to absorb the bubbles that are made if you're charging them at a reasonable rate. They probably have a safety valve somewhere if you go way beyond. But to my knowledge, these AGM batteries are lead acid with fancy chemistry, thoroughly sealed. And do you confirm all of the above, Rich? K2 APS, K2RIW?
Just looked it up. They're sealed lead acid batteries.
Yeah, K2 UPS. Thank you, Rich. Eric. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, K2 RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, like I said, in the descriptions that I was looking at, most of them did also use the letters AGM in addition to SLA or SLAB. And I was also looking at deep cycle ones, and they were rated where if you took them down to, say, 50 to 60% capacity, or used up that limit, only leaving 40%, you would only get maybe 200 charges into it, if that's what you did. But if you only brought it down 30%, leaving 70, and then would recharge it again and top it off, you could get over 1,000. This is just a chart on one of the pages when I was looking at the description. So the deeper you discharge them on a regular basis, it does shorten how many cycles you're going to get out of that battery. Now they also make different, you can get lithium batteries that fit in the same case. Of course, that's a different compound. You got to make sure you're using the right charge for that, and they are a lot more money. Much lighter weight, but a lot more money. And they have them in cases that are drop-in replacements for many of the 12-volt battery sizes, but I don't think that's an option here for Rich.
Okay, a couple of very important pieces of information there. So if Rich was recharging the chair every night, so therefore he wasn't going beyond, let's say, the 50% point, the chart you read said he would get 1,000 discharges, charge-discharge cycles, whereas if he more deeply discharges, he's only going to get 200. So therefore he really should be recharging every night. When it comes to the lithium batteries, which we're just talking about them, even though they're super expensive, are they also 35 ampere hours? And is there reason to believe that they would give more than 1,000 cycles of charge-discharge? What would Rich be getting for his money, so to speak, if he bought lithium equivalent? K2UPS, K2RIW, you got it, Rich.
Well, from what I've found, I would say the biggest thing is he's saving weight for the same size package. I believe the capacity is greatly increased, and the current draw is much higher. Or you can take a higher current draw out of it at a time. The discharge rate can be at a much higher level. I don't think that's much of an issue in a chair, unless maybe you're trying to start up on an incline, maybe. I don't know what kind of pull those motors put on it. But he might see an increase in performance with a battery like that. But like I said, you got to make darn sure that you have the right charger for that. You cannot charge the lithium with a lead acid charger. That bad things will happen real fast.
So what we have discovered tonight, Rich, and 2EO, the difference between 110 and 130 is not huge. The difference between brand names, I'm eventually going to go back to K2UPS and ask him his favorite brand of lead acid. You're not going to go to lithium because lithium is very expensive, and you'd have to also buy a new charger. And for all we know, redesign your chair, so to speak. It's too far. But I'm pretty sure your chair manufacturer was telling you a painful truth. Do recharge the chair every night. That way the lead acid batteries don't go to a deep discharge. That way you get 1,000 cycles instead of 200 cycles. That's five times more life. That's worth the investment of a little bit of inconvenience of recharging them every night. If not recharging them at noon as well as nighttime, if you know what I mean. So, as I see it there, Rich, you've got to obey those rules. And if he was about to choose a brand name, you have any preference that you know of, shipping charge, quality of product, or whatever, Rich K2UPS, do you think there's any particular brand name that he should steer for and steer away from any other? K2UPS, Mobile in Pennsylvania, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2UPS, not that I can mention offhand, Dick, like I said, I was just starting to research this. I have probably about a dozen different gel cell batteries of different capacities, anything from about 4 amp hour up to about 17 or 18 that I get from a friend of mine who pulls them out of medical equipment, who for, based by law, they have to pull them, I think, every year, whether they're good or not. They have to put a new one in, and the battery still has plenty of service life in. So, you know, no one into ham radio and I can get them, and they work pretty good. But offhand, I don't even know what brand those are. I had just started looking, but particularly if you're going to be shopping on Amazon, look at the custom reviews. What they say about it. If they say, oh, these are the best pens I've ever had, or if they say they're crap, you know. Sometimes the cheapest one isn't always the best one, but he's also going to have to look at the shipping charges, and it might actually just be cheaper to try to get them sourced locally, maybe through the BJ's or Costco. There are individual battery stores. I don't know if it's like Batteries R Us or Batteries Plus. I know there's a couple of different chain or franchise places like that, and there are at least one or two of them here on the island, and he might be able to get them. Even if the initial price of the batteries are higher than what he sees on Amazon, he's not paying shipping, and so that's a tax, I guess, but you know, check locally as well. But look at, if you're going to be shopping online, look at the customer reviews.
WS2M.
Clear the head, Paul, wait for the beep.
Yeah, instead of worrying about shipping, they have the same batteries actually in Walmart. And these are, you know, four wheelchairs. Two, you know, you get two of them, two for $135.99. You don't have to worry about shipping. If they don't have them available, you just tell them to get them, and they'll show up to the store, and they'll always have somebody pick them up. Could eliminate the shipping, and I think that would be a good way to go. And it's the UB12350. 35, each one is 35 amp hours. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, K2UPS, Rich, thank you. And Paul, WS2N, thank you. As I see it, Rich, N2EO, you started off this conversation hoping that brand A would be better than brand B when it comes to life. I think we slowly derived the fact that the biggest difference in life is whether or not you recharge them every single night. And so brand name may not be important, price may not be that much different, but you've got to treat them with tender loving care because you're very dependent on those batteries. And by way of Amazon, you can read the reports of how much people like them or dislike a particular brand name. Amazon has got these rating charts. And when it comes to, is the shipping significant? By way of Walmart and other stores where you can locally buy those batteries, you could save the shipping charge if the shipping charge is a significant percentage of the price. So recharging every night, I think, is the most important thing you've discovered tonight there, Rich. And I think your chair manufacturer was telling you a truth that you should have been listening to, if you know what I mean. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's right, Dick, I agree. I thought it was smarter. I'm not. Walmart, one of those Target, it's a good idea. Thing is, I can't get there. Patty doesn't have a car right now, but I'm going to talk to Jeremy, your son. See, during the week, he works for an exterminating company. It's a big company. I'll ask him if he'll take some time and go to one of these places and get them for me. How's that sound, Dick?
It sounds like a plan. And when it comes to installing the batteries, you probably have the right tools and the right knowledge of how to do that. Is that true, Rich? Go ahead.
Yes, I do. At one time, before I lost both my legs, I had a scooter. The batteries have to be checked. So I know. I'm sure Barry will give me a hand. He always comes through. That's why I know him over 45 years.
Yeah, Barry's a good guy. I think Barry's with his grandchildren at South Carolina these days. Okay, we've come up to the time when it's time for the space report. Paul, WS2N, you're going to give us, I think, space report number 265 of the series. And I wonder if any of those satellites up there that have been installed recently are giving some beautiful high-resolution pictures of what's going on in Houston with Hurricane Harvey. When you look at the news reports tonight, my goodness, is there grief down there. They've got an amount of water that's a once-per-500-year event.
many of their towns are devastated, and they've got ridiculous numbers of feet of water, and people are foolishly trying to drive their automobiles through that water and getting stuck and floating their vehicles. So I wonder if any of these recently installed satellites are giving high-resolution pictures of what's going on in Houston. WS2M, Space Report, K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got a call.
I did see a nice picture from the new satellite that they put up a few months ago, and it's not going to be really commissioned until November of this year. It takes roughly 6 months or so, sometimes longer, to calibrate everything. But it was a beautiful 3D type of picture from the GOES 16. Plenty of GOES satellites that have been put up, and this one's the 16th. You know, some are decommissioned. This one was, they went to a new type of design, the last one that went up. So the rainfall is, 50 inches now they're going to get Houston. And according to CNN reported, they're talking about not 500 a year, but a 1,000 year event. That's what they're looking at now. So we'll have to see. Talking about satellites, Saturday morning, actually, yesterday. There was a spacecraft that they sent up to look at all the satellites that are in geosynchronous orbit. You know, you have hundreds of these satellites that have been put up over the years. A 75 or so are actually operational. So what they wanted to do is put a satellite in low Earth orbit, roughly around 400 miles up. That's actually 390 miles up, but on the equator, a 0-degree inclination, with a camera looking out. So now this satellite's going around the Earth, not once every 24 hours like the geosynchronous satellite, but going around every 90 minutes with a big camera looking out this whole string of satellites. From that distance, with this camera, they can see, they have infrared camera, the high-pollution cameras, they can see satellites, they can see if there's two pieces, one broke apart, they can see if two of them are getting too close together, maybe an old one that's junk. If something fails, they can, have this thing look and find it very quickly. They, this goes around every hour and a half, so they can point the camera. They don't have to worry about actually changing the attitude of the satellite. They have a motor that can quickly move the camera and point it in the right direction to take pictures, which is good because it saves fuel on the satellite. And by doing that, it's going to last for many years. I think it's a minimum of three, probably five years or more. It's called a SenseSat, but they gave it another name, the ORS-5, but I go by the original name that they had, the SenseSat. And it was launched from Launch Complex 46, Cape Canaveral, down in Florida. And that launch complex hasn't been used in a while for a big launch like this. A company, Orbital ATK, that's the company that normally launches rockets out of Wallops Island and other different locations. The company that's building the solid boosters for the new space launch system, Orbital ATK. They make the Antares rocket that launches out of Virginia. They rebuilt Launch Complex 46, which really wasn't getting much use. And this took a while for us, and now it's finally time for their launch. They put a rocket out called the Minotaur 4, and essentially it's an old peacekeeping rocket that they used to use for possible nuclear war. So a lot of these rockets are left over, and Orbital ATK takes them, and they rework them, they redesign them, improve them, and in fact, they use the original, the four stage rockets, all solid, and then in this case, they put a fifth one on top to launch this relatively light satellite. I think it's only like 400 or 500 pounds or something. That went off on, it was supposed to go off Friday night late, like 11:30. Stayed up for it, and it was going to go off until I think it was 2:04 in the morning, Eastern Standard Time. So it was a cool launch, and Orbital ATK is a very active company, and in fact, I think in a couple of months we'll be seeing another launch from Wallops Island, Virginia, and they're usually the launches that we can actually see from Long Island, that, you know, you can see the flame, the glowing flame from the thrust of the Antares rocket. They have new engines that they built. They don't use the old Russian engines. They use new Russian engines, RS-181 engines. So that was pretty good. And then a couple of days before that, on Thursday, NASA had a launch. You know, the last launch I talked about, Orbital ATK, because it wasn't a NASA flight. They don't put it on NASA TV, but this one here, that launched from Vandenberg, California, Vandenberg Air Force Base, with the SpaceX Falcon 9 launch, and because it was for, well, whatever, it was with correction. Wait a minute. Stand by. Correction, this was not a NASA flight. This was a flight for Taiwan. They put a satellite up for Taiwan from California, and that was SpaceX Falcon 9, and this was one of these flights where they launched the rocket to the south. They wanted a polar launch, and it went into a polar orbit successfully, and the booster is another one of the boosters that they wanted to land on the drone ship out of the Pacific Ocean. So SpaceX has two drone ships, one in the Pacific Ocean and one in the Atlantic Ocean. So this was a Pacific flight. Watched the booster come down and landed dead center, right in the bullseye of the drone ship, which is about, you know, larger than a football field, out a couple hundred miles out in the Pacific Ocean. So that will float back vertically all the way back to Vandenberg Air Force Base, where they'll refurbish it and possibly refly that one in the future. They've done that a couple times already. And in fact, they have another flight coming up in a week or two, and that will be from Florida, that they'll be doing the same thing, relaunching our used booster. Let me drop it. So that's pretty much it as far as the launches go. In September, you have another launch of a crew going up to the International Space Station, and that'll be from Kazakhstan on the Russian Soyuz rocket. Pretty much it, Dick. There's a lot of new things happening. It's getting more complicated to keep up with this. All the launch complexes, for instance, down in Florida, that have been reactivated at the retirement of the space shuttle. You know, at the end, they were just using the one launch complex, 39A. They retired that. 39B was retired a while back after the one of the other space shuttle launches. So 39A has been taken over by SpaceX launch complex. Number 40 has been taken over by SpaceX. 41 has been taken over by United Launch Alliance. One I just mentioned here, taken over by Orbital ATK. Vector launched a rocket not too long ago from that same location. Going on and on. But in 2020, Blue Origin is going to be launching new rockets from Launch Complex 36. is picking up in Florida. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N for the space. Space report for the TechNet.
Do we have anyone out there that's got any further questions about space of any kind? For Paul, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, I heard just AC2 and then nothing further. That person come right back again. Go right ahead.
That was K. I don't hear Dick. We'll listen.
K, you got the floor. Go ahead and make a transmission.
Wondering if Kay perhaps does not have her PL on. WB2BXL here.
Yeah, that's a good thing to check on. Kay, make sure your PL is turned on because we only hear a couple of cycles, a couple of syllables out of you, and then nothing more. Possibly Kay is reprogramming her rig to make sure the PL is on 136.5. Anyone else have any further questions for Paul on the subject of space? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2H3R with a question.
November 2, Hotel Victor Romeo. Please start off with your name and then proceed with your question, sir.
Name here is Nick. Good evening, Dick, Paul. Quick question. When is America going to get their own launch system? I know they've been talking about they're going back to like the old, launch capability with a rocket and a capsule. Is there anything in the foreseeable future when we're going to have our own launch system in the U.S. and not rely on the Russians to get us to the space station? Back to you, N2H3R.
As I see it, that's in the works right now. WS2N, K2RIW, Greg Ball.
Yeah, if things go right 1 year from now, we'll be talking about how the first launch went up already. Probably looks like 2018 springtime. You'll probably see the first launch of a crew. Well, you'll have two people. You'll have somebody from NASA, an astronaut. And you'll have another astronaut from a private company called SpaceX. And they'll be they'll put two people in this thing first. And that'll be a Dragon crewed spacecraft. It's in development now. It's been in development for many, many years. They have the cargo version now going up to the space station. They're up to number 12. They just did their 12th cargo delivery. Crewed version looks similar, a little different than the cargo version. It will be able to carry actually up to 7 people, but you'll most likely see it going back and forth to the space station with 4 people. But they have to run some tests first. Probably at the end of this year, they'll send a crewed vehicle up without a crew to the International Space Station. Probably at the very end of this year or beginning of next year, drop in January. Then after a couple of months, if that goes okay, that will go up to the space station dock, and then we'll actually come back and land in the Pacific Ocean. If that goes good, then they'll send up 2 people, one NASA, one private astronaut, to test it out, bring it up, actually go to the space station, again, land in the Pacific Ocean. If that all goes okay, then NASA will certify the Dragon crewed vehicle. And, after that, they'll be able to do regular flights up to the space station with 4 people at a time. Now, that's SpaceX. The other company that's working on this, same type of deal is Boeing. Boeing has been constructing the Starliner spacecraft, CST-100, they used to call it, 100 being the common line. But they gave it a name. They call it the Starliner, so that's called the Starliner. Again, that will carry up to 4 people, and that will also be going to the International Space Station. A similar deal, like I said before, except they'll probably be a couple of months, 2-3 months behind SpaceX. And that's roughly the same schedule. So by the end of next year, you'll be able to see at least 1 or 2 crews, complete crews, the crew of 4 going up to the space station. And staying there for maybe up to 6 months. Each vehicle, the Starliner and the Dragon crewed vehicle, can stay attached to the International Space Station. I believe it's 255 days. That's lifetime. And then at that time, they can't go any longer. So they'll probably stay up to 6 months at a time and then come back with 4 people. You'll then have a permanent crew of 7 when that starts happening on the space station. Right now, you have a permanent crew of 6, either 6 or 3, depending if they're coming or going. They go up in 3s and come back down in 3s. So that's a rough idea of what they're doing. Back to you, Nick.
So as you see it, Nick, it's in the pipeline, and at least 2 companies within roughly a year are going to be launching American and foreign astronauts, but it'll be U.S. launching vehicles as opposed to the Russian launching vehicles. N2, Hotel Victor Romeo, K2RIW, you got it, Nick.
Roger, Dick. Yeah, it sounds good. I miss watching American launches on, you know, TV, ABC, NBC, CBS. Like when I was a kid watching all the Apollo programs and the shuttle. I guess they're going to use a recovery system on this new rocket just as a capsule coming in with a heat shield and then parachute into the ocean. Back to you. That's my final question.
Yeah, that's a darn good question. In the case of SpaceX, I'll bet you at least the first stage, if not the second stage, is going to be reusable and launch itself, recover itself back to the launch platform. So give us some words on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, with SpaceX, the booster will come back to Cape Canaveral any time they do a launch to the International Space Station. Now, with the cargo vehicle, the booster, which is about 115 stories high, a little taller than 150 feet, that first stage with the 9 engines attached, comes back and lands on the on ground on Launch Complex. Used to be Launch Complex 13. SpaceX rebuilt it, and they call it Landing Zone 1. They've done that about 4 or 5 different times now. And they'll do the same thing when they start launching crews. They'll bring the booster back and eventually reuse that. Yeah, second stage goes into orbit. The earlier flights, they just deorbit it, land in the Atlantic Ocean or the Indian Ocean. Right now what they're doing is refiring the second stage. Now after they release the Dragon, the second stage goes one whole trip around the Earth, then they light the engines again and deorbit it, and it burns up the atmosphere. The crew will be going to the space station. They spend months at a time at the space station. When they come back, there's a heat shield on the Dragon, and behind the heat shield is this big, they call it the trunk. The trunk is as big as the spaceship itself. So they usually put extra equipment on board, that telescopes, or they put a lot of things in the trunk section. Well, the trunk section is the part that also has the solar panels on board, and a lot of supply equipment, important stuff that the space vehicle will need. That part, the trunk, separates. Now that's as big as the capsule itself. In fact, it's a little bit bigger. Now we'll set on the way back. That will separate, and that piece will burn up in the atmosphere. Now the crew section will come back. It has they call it a pika, P-I-C-A, heat shield. Float them down, and then they'll have parachutes, and they'll go to their own recovery ship in the Pacific Ocean. And that's where they've been landing the crewed vehicles now, anyway, since they've been doing this the last couple of years. So they'll land in the water. They have long-term goals of actually bringing the crew back to land with propulsion rockets, but for now that's been canceled. Long-term goals, plans on actually bringing the crew back to land, you know, with these Super Draco engines that are mounted on the inside of the spacecraft. They're there now. I mean, they will be there now for the crew. In fact, that's what they're going to use for abort rockets. If there's an abort either on the pad or going up to orbit, Super Draco engines will ignite, and it will separate the capsule from the trunk and from the, you know, from the booster. And then it would come back and land again with a parachute. So that's what they plan on doing. Let me drop it. Boeing has a similar type of setup as well. They plan on launching with a vehicle called the Atlas V, which is very successful. They just don't have failures. Atlas V is very dependable, but it's an expendable rocket. That whole first and second stage, the first stage is... Will come back and land in the Atlantic Ocean. And the second stage is the Centaur rocket, RL-10 they call it. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. And that pushes the Starliner into orbit, and that thing will dock with the International Space Station. On the way back, Boeing, unlike SpaceX, is going to come back to land. Let me drop it. They're going to come back in the desert, call it a desert, in Utah, and they plan on coming back with a parachute, again with first with a heat shield parachute, and then right at the very end they're going to have these airbags that are going to pop out at the very bottom, going to cover the whole bottom of the capsule, and that's going to soften and blow when they hit the ground. So that's the Boeing plan, and if we wait until 2020, drop it. There'll be a new rocket by Blue Origin, and they'll, you know, give it a few years after their first launch. Their first launch will be 2020, and they're launching something that's called the New Glenn, also from Cape Canaveral, and that, you know, in the future, they are actually developing a manned spacecraft that will also be able to go into orbit. Now, they're all going to be going to the International Space Station. Eventually, in the future, there's going to be other space stations, other projects for these companies to be doing. So, that's it. Back to you, Dick, WS.
Let's see if Nick has any further questions on all of the above. Go ahead, Nick.
No, that's it for tonight. I'm good till next week. Thanks for that. Yeah. Well, they're going back to what works and what's reliable, coming back and with the parachutes and heat shields. The space shuttle never really turned out to be what it was meant to be. I think it was just too overcomplicated. I think staying simple works better. Anyway, that's my opinion. Back to you and back to Lynette. This is N2HVR.
Maybe Nick wants to hear about the Dream Chaser. I think he's thinking about that.
Why don't you give him a few words on that?
Yeah, okay, now I know. Yeah, when we were younger, me too, I would watch all these rockets go up and they come back in a capsule, and that's what it's going to be kind of similar to watching SpaceX and Boeing do their Starliner and Dragon, and also with Orion, being built by NASA, that will be coming back as a bigger capsule than previous two that I mentioned. But there's another company called Sierra Nevada Corporation, SNC, and they're developing the Dream Chaser. And Dream Chaser started off as being crewed vehicle. They've now changed to cargo, but again, in the future, they'll change back to crew. Now, they have a contract for 6 flights to go to the International Space Station.